I next met with Dr. Maria Capellini, who graciously sat down for the interview in spite of the fact that she was fighting a cold. And to begin, she talked about the pathophysiology of thalassemia.
There is no doubt that definitely during the last 30 years, the natural history of thalassemia had significantly changed. And that's thank you to better understanding the pathophysiology underlying the disease and the progression of the treatment. Starting from the understanding, I should say that in the 60s, 70s, when it came clear that the pathophysiology was based on the severity of imbalance between the globin chains, let's make clear that the best way to correct this pathophysiological mechanism was to suppress the thalassemic erythropoiesis through blood transfusion. But let me say a little bit more about ineffective erythropoiesis, which is the driver of the pathophysiology of thalassemia. As you know, the globin structure is characterized by a tetramer of globin chain in adult life, two alpha globin chain and two beta globin chains. And these must be very well paired in order to have stable molecules. But for any reason, if we have a deficiency in terms of production of alpha or beta globin chain, of course, we have an excess of the normally synthesized globin chain, which precipitate into the erythroblast, and that's cause the so-called ineffective erythropoiesis. Generally speaking, beta thalassemia are in some way more common than alpha thalassemia, especially in the Mediterranean country. And that is also explained by the fact that there are two genes synthesizing the beta globin chain, whereas we have four genes synthesizing alpha globin chain. So you can understand that is enough to have a molecular defect of a single gene for each allele to cause a severe disease for the beta, whereas we need four mutations in the four gene alpha genes for having alpha thalassemia. So clinically speaking, we are more keen to speak about severe beta thalassemia. So having said that, going back to the pathophysiology, if we have a beta thalassemia, this means that we have an excess of alpha globin chain free into the erythroblast. They precipitate, as I already said, causing ineffective erythropoiesis. Ineffective erythropoiesis means erythroblast dying within the bone marrow and production of red cells, which goes into peripheral blood, but very damaged, undergoing hemolysis. So all this is causing anemia. Severe anemia means increased erythropoietin. Increased erythropoietin means extramedullary hematopoiesis masses, means increased iron absorption. So going back to the 70s, when this pathophysiological mechanism was better understood, the first approach was, what can we do? We can transfuse this patient in order to suppress this bone marrow with an effective erythropoiesis. And that was established with a regular blood transfusion regimen. However, blood transfusion in these patients means iron overload, because the iron released when the red cell breakdown cannot be utilized. So anemia, extramedullary erythropoiesis masses, iron overload. So what can we do? Transfuse the patients, but we need also to remove the iron accumulated. And around the late 60s, beginning of 70s, a compound named desferrioxamine was by chance identified as an iron chelator. And that patients start to be properly chelated with subcutaneous infusion of the Esferal, the serioxamine, 8 hours per day, which was good, which was really changing the survival, because before patients were dying for heart failure due to iron overload, they start to be chelated, they survive better, but nevertheless to be adherent to such a demanding iron chelation was a real challenge. So many patients in the 80s, 90s, and even early 2000, they used to die, unfortunately, for heart failure and cirrhosis due to liver iron accumulation. Moreover, before the 1980s, before the screening for hepatitis C, a lot of these patients were becoming hepatitis C positive due to blood transfusion. So there was, let's say, a series of comorbidities due to the treatment. Let's move to the 85, when bone marrow transplantation was coming in front. At that time, there was two different points of view. Some physicians were supporting the standard of care. Some were supporting bone marrow transplantation. So at that time, it was quite difficult to deal with one or the other. But by the way, the Italian group by Professor Lucarelli improved the outcome of bone marrow transplantation. They made a very good approach to myoablation, so situation improved, patient survived, and a lot of bone marrow transplantation have been performed. However, we have to underline that for thalassemia, bone marrow transplantation is very successful whenever it's conducted, is done with an HLA identical donor, which is different than in leukemia. In leukemia, you can also have mismatched donors. To be successful with thalassemia, the best is to have a HLA identical donor. So having said that, this means that not all the thalassemia patients may undergo bone marrow transplantation, but only those who have an appropriate donor. But nevertheless, that also contributes. Let's say something else which changed a little bit the natural history of the disease, the introduction of prenatal diagnosis. Prenatal diagnosis was introduced on DNA, on chorionic villi in the late 90s. That means that prenatal diagnosis could have been performed in an early stage of pregnancy, so was more acceptable for the couple, and that in some country was really a preventing approach. In Italy, for example, the newborn rate dropped significantly in those age because many couple decided to go to abortion if the fetus was affected.
Could I just ask you, I'm curious what the prevalence and the incidence of thalassemia is in Italy, and for example, how it compares, let's say, the United States?
Well, for thalassemia, United States is not very much involved because the prevalence of the mutation for thalassemia were mainly diffused in the Mediterranean area, so Italy, Greece, South Mediterranean, Middle East, and Southeast Asia. So the thalassemia patients in the United States were the Italian or Greek migrants. The prevalence in Italy for the mutation was for some area like Sardinia, south of Italy, the carrier were almost 3% of the population, which means that we have, in terms of alive thalassemia patients, something like 7,000-8,000, okay? In altogether, all over United States, the number are much, much, much less. But in country like, for example, Thailand, they are 1,000. In Middle East, if we are talking of Egypt, they have 20,000 patients in Iran. So it's really very, very common in some country. Prevalently, are country where malaria was prevalent, because malaria was a natural selecting disease, which means that the carrier of the mutated thalassemia gene survived malaria, and that was a natural selection. In the United States, there was no malaria, at least, and that's, they don't have their own thalassemia patients, are usually migrant from Italy or Greece or other part of the world.
Another thing I want to ask you about before we get into sort of some of the new developments in the field is the classification. And I noticed that now, I guess that starts to lead into the trials, but it looks like now it's based on transfusion dependency or
exactly.
not. Why did that happen and what does it mean?
Okay. First of all, you have to know that thalassemia is a recessive disorder, okay? So to have an affected person, he must or she must inherit two defective genes, one from the mother, one from the father. If we stay on the beta thalassemia setting, you have to know that within the beta gene, there are more than 350 known mutations. Some of them are very severe, causing a completely shut down of the gene function, and they are called beta zero mutation. Some are called beta plus because they affect the function of the gene, but actually there is a residual activity of the gene, so means that some beta chain are produced. So among 400 mutations, you can imagine the many possibilities there are, because a subject can inherit, for example, a beta zero from a father, a beta plus from the mother, or both are beta zero, or both are beta plus. So for clinician, using the genotyping was a mess, because they see all this genotype, what they mean. So more recently, under the supervision of Professor David Wetherall, who unfortunately passed away a few months ago, and he was really the father of thalassemia, a group of experts decided to provide a more clinical classification based on the transfusional need. So we have a kind of error. At one extreme, there are those who are just carrier, so they are considered as a normal subject, just having a very mild microcytic anemia. And usually they are the parents of the patients and they don't need any clinical support. But on the other extreme, there are the very severe ones, those who to survive require to be regularly transfused, which means to receive monthly from 2 to 3 units of blood. In between these two extremes, there is a huge spectrum of different genotype combination. The mild form are more close to the simple carrier, and they actually may survive with an hemoglobin level of 8-9 without need really to be transfused. In the middle, there are patients who may require to be transfused in some circumstances, for example, viral infection, hemoglobin drop, they require transfusion, surgery, or any comorbidity who cause a drop of hemoglobin. So this is really a gray zone where you have all these patients who are named non-transfusion dependent thalassemia. And this kind of classification is now becoming quite convenient for clinicians, especially for adult clinicians. And I'm glad that I'm targeting an audience of adult physicians. Why I'm saying that? Because thalassemia, till a few years ago, was a disease almost completely cared by pediatricians. because these patients were not surviving longer than 20, 30 years. Now they are surviving much longer, so they move from pediatric setting to adult setting, but very often the adult physician are not ready to receive them.
What is the usual cause of death in these patients?
In the past, used to be iron overload. Although they were chelated with desferrioxamine because of poor adherence to such a demanding treatment. Can you imagine every day a pump, 8 hours a day, compliance were very poor. So till a few years ago, the main cause was heart failure due to iron overload. Now this is very well overcome because of new iron chelator, but unfortunately we are dealing with other cause of that. One is hepatocellular carcinoma or cirrhosis due to, again, possible iron load in the liver plus hepatitis C infection, which wasn't treated in the past. Or still we don't know, but even if the iron was removed from the liver, but the persistence of fibrosis can be a, let's say, potential cause of development of cirrhosis, and they may die for evolution of cirrhosis to hepatocellular carcinoma. Beyond that, of course, these are patients that even surviving longer, they survive, as I say, now they survive on the fifth, some even during 6 decades, but they are very fragile patients, so they are exposed to any other possible disease to which is exposed the general population. But whenever they are affected, let's say cardiovascular disease, endocrinological disorders such as diabetes and so on, they of course have a course of disease more severe, and they may die for this reason.
So I want to focus our discussion on new developments in the field. I'd like to hear about erythroid maturation agents, particularly luspatercept, and what was presented at the ASH meeting, but also about gene therapy. But let's start out talking about these, I guess, new class of agents, the erythroid maturation agents. Can you talk a little bit about your vision of sort of biologically how these agents actually work?
This is really opening a new era of treatment for thalassemia, and let's go back again on focusing on the pathophysiology. If you think the pathophysiology that I tried to explain before, the ineffective erythropoiesis is the main driver of the disease. So ineffective erythropoiesis is due to an imbalance of globin chain. We have two possibilities to correct the imbalance, and that can be gene therapy. I put the gene into the stem cells, I get the production of the missing chain. Or I may correct at cellular level, so in the process of erythroid differentiation and maturation, the ineffective erythropoiesis. So I'm going to target the ineffective erythropoiesis. And let's say that luspatercept, which is a first-in-class drug, who is a active receptor trap, was identified just by chance, because it was a molecule used in trial to be used for correcting the osteoporosis in menopausal women. And what was observed in this normal, in terms of erythropoiesis, women was an increase in hemoglobin and an increase in red cell number. So this prompted to stop the trial for those purposes and look in vitro what was going on. So in mice model was clearly shown that this molecule was acting on, let's say, most probably acting on BCL11A, which is a factor involved in the control of the erythropoiesis. Acting on that, it can modulate a pathway, I don't go into details, but it modulates a pathway of a SMAD which control the process of erythroid maturation, which is different than the mechanism of action of erythropoietin, because erythropoietin, which is the hormone which control erythropoiesis, is acting much earlier, is acting on the erythroid precursors. Luspatercept is acting on the phase of erythroblast, so on the phase of maturation, and that's control the ineffective erythropoiesis, most probably leading the survival of erythroblast, which are well compensated in terms of globin production.
So just to clarify a little more, because when I hear the SEP thing on the end of it, the only other thing I could think of was aflibercept, which is used, I think, in colon cancer. And my understanding is it sucks up VEGF. So is this also a ligand sucker?
Well, it's a ligand of a receptor. It blocks, is an antagonist of activin receptor. This molecule binds to a receptor, blocking the receptor, is controlling, acting on BCL11, is controlling this pathway of SMAD1, different control of erythropoiesis. So is actually active on a receptor of activin.
So can you talk a little bit about the clinical research that's been done? I know there are two agents that have been looked at.
Well, one was sotatercept and one was luspatercept, but now they merge and we are going to use only luspatercept. They are very similar, and belong to the TGF-beta family, okay? The choice for focusing on luspatercept is just because it's not affecting some potential pathway of hormonal pathway. So treating young patients, we prefer to use luspatercept, but they are very, very similar. What has been done was a preclinical study in mice. They confirm what I mentioned. Then we did a phase two study. I was involved in both of them. I was involved with the sotatercept. And the phase two was more explorative in terms of dose escalation in order to identify the right dose. And that was including a small number of patients, either transfusion dependent or non-transfusion dependent. And with both of the molecules, what we found was a reduction of more than 20% of blood transfusion burden in those transfusion dependent, and an increase of more than 1 or 2 grams of hemoglobin in those non-transfusion dependent. That was in a limited number of patients and for a short period of time. We identified that the right dosage was 1 mg/kg/day, and that's prompted to design the phase 3 trial, which has been presented at ASH with luspatercept. And the results are very promising. The data have been submitted to FDA. So in phase 3, the study was a randomized, double-blind study, including the BELIEVE study in transfusion-dependent thalassemia patients. There is a BEYOND study still ongoing in non-transfusion-dependent. The one completed is in transfusion-dependent. We enroll 366 thalassemia transfusion-dependent patients in 35 countries, 65 centers. The randomization was 2 patients randomized for the drug and 1 for placebo. And the primary endpoint was a reduction of blood consumption for at least equal or more than 33% compared to baseline, a fixed period during the year of observation, or even more than that, more than 50, that was a secondary endpoint, more than 50% reduction of blood transfusion. Just to make the long story short, We achieve all the primary and secondary endpoint with the luspatercept treatment, and moreover, looking at the results, not in a fixed period, fixed week, but in a rolling way process, which means that at any time during the year of treatment, we observed that a large proportion of patients achieved a reduction of blood consumption higher than 70%, which means a lot, really a lot. Because if a patient is receiving, for example, let's say 30 units of blood per year, 70% reduction is really impressive, which means much less session of transfusion, a long interval between the need of transfusion and significant reduction of iron intake. So the results are quite impressive and very promising. Keep in mind that this treatment is a subcutaneous injection like insulin, just a small injection every 3 weeks. And that is going to substitute the blood transfusion.
Any evidence of tachyphylaxis as time goes on?
Not at all. So far, we had no tachyphylaxis. And if you want to spend the word in terms of adverse event, comparing the adverse event in the placebo group and the treated group, they are very similar, but just a mild increase of bone pain in treated patients, especially at the beginning of treatment, which is personally, I'm not surprised of that, because if the bone marrow is going to improve, probably at the beginning there is a little bit of expansion which may cause some bone pain, but then it stabilizes because the effective erythropoiesis is going to take over and not the ineffective erythropoiesis. So there will not be an expansion of the bone marrow long term. So this is the only difference at the beginning. We observed also few episodes of thrombotic events, but again, I have to mention that thrombotic risk is a major challenging thalassemia patients, especially those who are splenectomized. So at the end of the evaluation, the average of patients who had thrombotic events was not higher than that we observed in the general thalassemia population. So at this very moment, having concluded the BELIEVE study, I think the results are definitely superior to the placebo group and are quite consistent to be considered a future treatment.
And I'm assuming the treatment is indefinite?
That's for sure. This is expected. We need, of course, to have a longer follow-up now to see how it goes. But personally, I'm expecting that is a kind of treatment which must be maintained. Maybe, but of course this is a pure speculation, maybe that long term the administration can be delayed, because whenever the bone marrow will be, let's say, stabilized in some way, maybe we don't need to keep the bone marrow under treatment.
It's interesting, you know, looking at this area of research, how the endpoints are very interesting to me, you know, coming from an oncology background. And you mentioned the fact, and the paper, of course, talks about the 70% hitting that goal in terms of response rate. But I don't know if you have like sort of a waterfall plot. Do pretty much all patients improve, or are there some patients who just don't have any response?
It's still difficult to say. And that's something that I also like to discuss with my colleagues and even with those involved in clinical trials. Actually, some patients cannot be defined good responder, because maybe they have an initial response and then maybe they stop it, or vice versa. they are not responding at the beginning, but later on they start to respond. And that, to me, is mainly due to the huge heterogeneity of the patients. Not all the patients enrolled have the same bone marrow status. When they are enrolled, some of them have a very suppressed bone marrow, some have a bone marrow which is still a little bit active. So I think that this is the type of the so-called personalized treatment that really should be personalized patient by patient. But to say that, we need to collect more data and mainly more long-term data.
So you mentioned, you talked about this BELIEVE study that was in patients with transfusion dependence. And it's really interesting, this study, and the non-transfusion dependence. What are the endpoints?
Well, increase of hemoglobin. That is because they are patients non-transfused or occasionally transfused, the endpoint is the increase of hemoglobin, more than 2 grams compared to baseline. Of course, I cannot disclose the data because it's still ongoing, but the preliminary results are very, very encouraging.
But I would assume the long-term goal is to prevent complications of extramedullary hematopoiesis.
Absolutely. And also the consequences of a chronic anemia, because, you know, those non-transfusion dependent patients, okay, 20 years ago I used to tell them, you are lucky because you are not going through blood transfusion. Nowadays I say, really, the consequences of a chronic anemia are severe.
And what about, as long as you bring that up, what's your vision of the anemia of chronic disease? And do you think that that would respond to this? And if so, what kind of impact do you think this would have?
That is an area of great interest because, as you know, in anemia of chronic disease, what became clear during the last few years is that the iron utilization is wrong, because the iron is not released from the macrophages and is not utilized by the bone marrow. So the bone marrow goes through some ineffective erythropoiesis, and I believe that it could be an area to explore with this kind of treatment. And of course, in terms of, let's say, disease impact, I mean, the anemia of chronic disease is one of the major causes of anemia. But I want to mention, because of your audience of oncologists, that one of the very interesting settings is myelodysplasia. There are very interesting results in MDS. Data have been already published for phase 2, and they also completed the phase 3 trial, and the results are amazing, especially in a subset, the sideroblastic anemia.
So I was just thinking, I'd love to come visit your clinic. Probably any physician in the United States or outside of the thalassemia world would really find it interesting to see all the patients that you see. I'm curious how this actually plays out in clinical practice and what you see in terms of when, you know, in these patients on the trial, of course it was blinded, but probably you had some idea what was going on.
And they were coming back saying, doctor, I'm sure I'm taking the drug because I feel,
wow,
you know, was blind officially.
Wow. Wow.
But
that's
they
amazing.
Were, it was really amazing. Anyway,
I was sort of flashing. I remember when I first started to hear stories about ruxolitinib and myelofibrosis,
yeah,
you know, what I was hearing about how it affected people's quality of life. And here, you know, okay, you're getting a sub-Q injection, you're not getting transfusion. You know, it's not exactly like in myelofibrosis where they have this incredible response. But now I'm thinking that from a quality of life point of view, that these people, their lives must change.
That's what we are looking for. You know, if we evaluate during the clinical trial with the transfusion dependent, which is different for the other, the quality of life, initially we don't get much difference because patients transfused in terms of well-being, he was doing well. Of course, there was the let's say, affecting the quality of life, because they had to come to the hospital for blood transfusion, they had to chelate and so on. But in terms of well-being, the differences was not perceived immediately. Now that are starting to be longer on treatment, they also perceive the change of quality of life, because they say, well, I'm not coming every 3 weeks. I will come every 3 months. I can do what I want. Probably in the future, I will not need any chelation anymore. So it's changing. For the non-transfusion dependent, we already see a significant change in quality of life.
Yeah, that's interesting. So the non-transfusion dependent patients come in and they say they feel better. Do you think it's just the hemoglobin or is it something else?
For sure, for them is the hemoglobin level, because if a patient moves from 7 grams of hemoglobin to 9, immediately notice the difference.
Wow.
And the comment they do is, oh my God, I didn't realize that I could have been better, you know, because they were used to stay with 7 grams.
Wow.
I just met this morning one of my patients, lovely girl. She was coming out from the outpatient and they said, how are you feeling? She said, I'm going to gym every day now. I feel so good. So, you know, they really perceive the well-being. It's only hemoglobin. That's what we think, but we will see.
Let me ask you, how would you like to use this agent, theoretically? Put aside cost and regulatory issues. In what situations do you think it ideally should be used, at least in these patients?
I'm always very cautious when there are new drugs and new approaches. And I'm not going to say it will be the treatment for all the thalassemia patients. What I say is that from now we have to learn who will be the right patients. And as you know better than me, that's true for cancer, it's true. We have to learn who will be good for what. And why I'm going to say that? Because now we have different options, including gene therapy, and then we may touch it. And I'm sure that there will be subset of patients who will be better responders to this treatment. New agents are on the way, and they could be tested also for other molecules. So far, I'm in favor to treat, definitely, I will be very positive on treating non-transfusion-dependent patients, although the trial is not ended. But I guess that that will be a good cohort of patients. Among those transfusion-dependent, I really like to treat those who have less comorbidity as possible, because those 30, 40 years of age patients, they have some comorbidity, endocrine problem and so on. So the better they are, the better I'm expecting to respond. Apparently, there are no real exclusion criteria. Probably those with less severe genotype could respond better. So if I have a beta zero, beta plus, instead of a beta zero, beta zero, it could be possible they respond better. But as I said, I don't want to be too much, let's say, conclusive. We need to have a follow-up and see. That's my, really, I would like to be able to do that, subsetting the patients according to their potential response.
Anyhow, let's talk about gene therapy of thalassemia. Can you talk about sort of what we know about that at this point?
Today, I can say that 10 days ago, gene therapy was registered by EMA officially. So now it has been recognized. I think it's under evaluation by FDA, but we are at this stage. In principle, gene therapy is a cure for thalassemia, definitive cure. And that's my view. I mean, if you ask me, are you going to choose gene therapy or luspatercept? My answer is, I'm sure that gene therapy cure, I go to gene therapy. But if gene therapy is reducing the requirement of blood transfusion, well, I consider also the other possibility. Where are we now? The data available and the dose presented to the authorities, EMA and the FDA, are the results presented in the New England paper back April or May 2018, where a limited number of patients were treated, where we can catch up a couple of messages. First of all, not all the patients responded completely. I think that 70% became transfusion independent, approximately, but some patients reduced only the consumption of blood. And the comment of the authors is that the better responder are the non-beta zero, beta zero. So those patients with a genotype which has, let's say, residual production of beta chain. So the genotype beta zero, beta plus. That was the states. And I think that the registration so far is for non-beta zero, beta zero patients. The most recent data presented at ASH last December, including results of different clinical trials, are much better than the one presented in the paper, are definitely more promising. What was improved was the transcription, because the major challenge in gene therapy is to have a good viral vector which is able to transduce the gene within the stem cells.
Could you actually go through the actual process of how it's done?
So gene therapy is very similar in terms of preparation to the bone marrow transplantation, but there is a substantial difference, which is the harvesting of stem cells from the patients. Okay, so stem cells are harvested from patients by, usually we treat them with a plerixaform, as is done in bone marrow, to get as much as possible stem cells. The stem cells are manipulated with, of course, is the transduction of the beta gene within the stem cells. Of course, the beta gene to enter the stem cells need to be vehiculated, and the vehicle is a viral vector. It is a vector. After many years where it was difficult to select the proper vector, now the selected vectors are lentivirus. Okay? So for thalassemia gene therapy, the lentivirus are the vector. So what happens is that the beta gene is integrated into the viral vector. So the product, because at the end of the day is a product, which is this vial containing the lentiviral, the integrated gene, that is giving back to the bone marrow center, and the stem cells are given back to the patients. And after that, the hope is that the beta gene start to work through the differentiation and maturation of stem cell. So there are two important points. First of all, a good rescue of stem cells from the patient, but that in terms of numbers is usually good. The good transduction of the stem cells, and then the copy numbers of the viral vector to be active. Of course, in all this process, the patient has to be prepared to receive back the stem cells. So he has to undergo two myoablation, as in a bone marrow transplant. So in terms of procedure, it's demanding anyway. So it's not an easy process, although it's safe in terms of safety no concern have been arisen. Of course, again, we need long-term follow-up to see what is going to happen. I think that it can be further improved because the transduction based on the most recent result has been improved furtherly. So the copy number transcribed is increased. So far, as you probably notice or know, there are two groups working on that. One is a company which is working in the United States, but now is opening clinical trial all over Europe, and a more scientific group, which is an Italian group supervised by Professor Naldini, who is a well-known person in gene therapy for other diseases like leukodystrophy and so on. And this is based in Milan and is a TGET group. And three of my adult patients underwent gene therapy in their clinical trial. And both are working, improving the process.
You mentioned that it's been proven to be safe. Are there any complications or toxicities?
So far, no. Well, the toxicity can be related to the myoablation, you know, as for they may have infection, but these are manageable as they are in bone marrow transplantation. Of course, there is an advantage, no risk of graft versus host rejection, because these stem cells are the patients, they are their own stem cells.
So I'm curious what your vision is in terms of the future. Any other new strategies that you're excited about? And, you know, what's your prediction or vision for 5 or 10 years from now?
Well, listen, I am in the field since more than 40 years. And for almost 40 years, we had no other alternative than blood transfusion, chelation, and bone marrow. Now we are running almost 5-6 different clinical trials. Besides luspatercept gene therapy, also we are involved, but there are in phase 2 at least 2 other molecules which approach the problem in a different way, but the results, the end point is anyway to correct ineffective erythropoiesis, and they are mainly based on mini hepcidin or hepcidin. So hepcidin is the driver of the iron distribution in the body, and it has been shown in animal models that administering hepcidin, you may act on the use of iron at bone marrow level, and that may cause an improvement of ineffective erythropoiesis. These are in a very preliminary phase, but they will be on development in the next, I think, 5 years. Some of them, to my point of view, which is absolutely personal, will be probably effective in combination to other more substantial treatment, not as a monotherapy. To me, for the next 5 years, the attention will be focused on luspatercept and gene therapy.
This concludes our program. Special thanks to the faculty, and thank you for listening. This is Dr. Neil Love for Novel and Emerging Therapeutic Strategies in the Management of Hematologic Disorder-Related Anemia.